Blog Talk Radio.
And some of you will be kicked and bullied.
been humbled.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Red Fox Blogger with your hosts, Tim Burton and Count Fritzy. Hope everybody's doing well today. And Tim, hello, how are you today?
Well, good evening, Kel, and how the devil are you tonight?
Infidelity fine. As always. How about you?
Well, that's good. Oh, I'm unbelievably good as well, so thank you for asking. It's always nice
Absolutely.
To be asked.
Absolutely. You know, I'll tell you something. We play that opening song, and when you listen to the lyrics, of course it's very doom and gloom, but it's pretty bad when you're still kind of tapping your feet to it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I actually think that's one of the best intro songs that I've heard, and for two reasons. One is that it gets into people's heads and it makes them think about what 9:29 actually means, because it's a mm-hmm. crucial verse
exactly.
in the Quran. And if you're at all interested in what Islam means to us non-believers, then it's as well to come to grips with 9:29 and what it means. And that song pretty much sums it up. But also, We do have to inject a little bit of lightness and humour into a subject that if we didn't inject the lightness and humour, we wouldn't stand a chance in fighting it. If we took it seriously, in so much as we forbade ourselves to actually make fun of Islam, then it would be quite difficult to do the work that we do. One of the things about what we do is, although it is a serious subject, is we approach it in a way that makes people feel really positive about what can be done, because it's not as if it's the end of the world. We could be faced with far more problems. I remember talking to young Tommy English on this, and he was saying, wouldn't it have been great if on the night that Muhammad was conceived, if his mum had just turned over and said, no thanks, I've got a headache. And I said, yeah, that would be great, Tommy, but at least we have a problem here today now that can be dealt with, that is actually able to be dealt with, whereas if there had never been such a thing as Islam, you never know.
Mm-hmm.
We might be presented with something which would be even harder to deal with, or maybe impossible to deal with. So count your blessings, is what I say. Count your blessings.
Absolutely. And you know what? We put the fun in Islam. We do. That
the fun in
fundamentalism. Everything about that. Yeah, I really do thank Vlad Tepes for sending that to us, because it's brilliant. And You listen to the lyrics, but it's interesting the instruments behind it and the upbeat that they put behind it. It's like, you know what, Islam? F you. We're going to take that 9:29 and we're going to educate the people in our way, not your way.
Yeah.
And I like that.
Yeah, and I just thought you could say, indeed, Kel, you could say, we put the F-U in fun and the fun in fundamentalism. So I think that works out really well. So,
I think that's wonderful. Hey, and Tim, tell me mm-hmm. about what you received in the mail this week.
Oh, wow, yes. Well, I opened up a parcel that was delivered to me today, and what should come out but a lovely coffee mug with my favourite person printed on it. And I'll give you a clue as to who this famous person might be. At the top of the mug, it says, mendacious, grievance-mongering taqiya artist, lying about Islamophobia since 2012. Anybody guessing? No, there's no guesses in the chat room yet.
Come on, people.
Well, it also says Tell Mama on there, and you've got the Tell Mama logo. And a lovely picture of this gentleman at the top. And as everybody knows, he's my pin-up boy for at least until April the 8th next month. And after that, I hopefully will be sweeping him up off the courtroom floor. So,
Bigfoot
says, yeah, Bigfoot guest. I think it might be Fiaz Magali, says. I must have given it away with my clues there, Gail. What do you think?
I know. And you know what, people? If you scroll up and look at the pictures above the show notes, you will see that beautiful mug there. And you know what? You, too, can possess this collector's edition, this item that would be worth millions if you can answer a trivia question. Every Monday for the next few weeks, we will be giving out a trivia question. The first person who calls in with the correct answer wins their very own Mendacious Grievance Mongering Takiya Artist Coffee Mug. Now, all you have to do is answer the question. And this week's question is, why is 9/11, September 11th, why is that such an important day to Islamists? If you can phone in and tell us why is September 11th such a significant date to the Islamists, you win a coffee mug courtesy of RFB Tim Burton in Kilfordsey. So there you go.
Yep.
I'll be repeating that question off and on.
That's right. And just to say that we're not talking about the 9/11/2001, which obviously is the one that comes to mind.
We're talking about the date in history. That's right.
Yeah, that's it, date in history. So have a think about that, people, and please phone in. First one to phone in gets a Mendacious Grievance Mongering Takiya Artist coffee mug. And as Kel says, these are going to be collector's items in the future. People at antique auctions will be saying, now, do we have any old masters for sale? A Rembrandt, perhaps? A Manet, perhaps a Turner? And the voice at the back go, no, but I do have a Mendacious Grievance Mongering Takiya Artist coffee mug. And everybody in the auction room will go, well, I've got to have that. Let's put it up and see how much it fetches. So, yes, if you want something for your children and grandchildren to look at and say, I was there on the day.
Oh, yeah, and that's right.
That's right.
And Bigfoot, thanks for pointing that out. Bigfoot was our first winner. If you've already won one, please... I'm so sorry, but you can apply for a T-shirt down the road sometime. But, yes, these mugs, first edition, they will be worth a fortune.
Certainly will. So what have we got tonight, Kel? I think we've got a packed program tonight, haven't we?
We do.
For a moment there, I thought you were going to say no.
Sorry,
I'm
typing in the chat room.
I've got nothing. Okay.
I don't know. What are you talking? I thought
well,
you had
right.
something.
Well, I do. And
we do have a topic, ladies and gentlemen, as you can see in the show notes, that we're going to be talking about Islamic brainwashing and is that child abuse. And we're going on the premise of this article that the mayor in London, England, Boris Johnson, he made a statement. He equated radicalization of children and brainwashing them into terrorism as a form of child abuse. Now, Boris Johnson said children deemed as being at risk of being radicalized should be taken away from their families to stop them being turned into potential killers or suicide bombers. All right, that's all very well and good. But when Tim and I were talking about this, we had quite... a lively discussion about it, and that, how to tackle that one. But let me just read a little bit of the article for everyone, Tim, and we'll delve into it. Now, as I mentioned, Boris Johnson said children deemed at risk of being radicalized should be taken away from their families to stop them being turned into potential killers or suicide bombers. He wrote to us, say, Muslim children who risk radicalization by their parents should be taken into care. He said the problem of radicalization is not getting conspicuously worse, nor is it going away. He said there are a few thousand people in London, pardon me, the low thousand, they say, who have interest in security service, and a huge amount of work goes into monitoring those people into making sure that their ranks are not swelled by new victims. Now, according to him, what has been less widely understood is that some young people are now being radicalized at home by their parents or by their step-parents. Oh, madrasas, mosque. Sorry. The law should obviously treat radicalization as a form of child abuse. It is the strong view of many of those involved in counterterrorism that there should be a clearer legal position so that those children who are being turned into potential killers or suicide bombers can be removed into care for their own safety and for the safety of the public, Johnson said. Okay, I'm going to pause the verbatim reading right there. And Tim, oh, my God. So, gee, you think there's a problem in Islam?
I can't think what it might be, Kel. First I've heard of it. Yes, in all seriousness, Boris Johnson, our lovable London mayor, and for those of you who are across the pond and don't know Boris Johnson very well, he's a bit of an eccentric. He's one of these old Etonian characters. He doesn't really care very much about what people think, which is a good thing, but he does tend to open his mouth and speak before he engages his brain. Now, sometimes you might think, well, that's very endearing, but in this instance, I think he's actually opened himself up to he's opened himself up to the subject in a way which I don't think he really intended. And I'm quite surprised that not many people seem to have made as much of it as I thought they would. What it means is that if you were going to institute a program of taking children away from their parents due to the possibility of radicalization, who is going to define what radicalization really is? Because there's obviously a case to be made for the doctrine of Islam containing, as it does, a developed theology of Islam contains a doctrine of warfare, eternal warfare against non-believers that is valid for all times and all places. And given that we have that, you could say that any teaching of true Islam to impressionable young children could effectively constitute a form of brainwashing which would fall under that radicalization category. And of course that opens up a whole can of worms. Now, I personally don't think that we're going to get very far if we say, yep, let's take every single Muslim child off their parent because they're going to be more than likely open to Islamic radicalization. But nevertheless, I think it's an interesting thing for discussion. So I'll pass the mic back to you, Kel, because I understand we've got a caller on the line.
We do. And this might be, we might have a winner. And let's bring them on right now. And 0791, welcome to the Red Fox Blogger. What's your name? What's your comment? And do you have an answer to our trivia question?
Hi, Kel. It's Eric from Iowa. How are you?
Eric, how are you? Doing well. Great to hear your voice.
Yeah
hi,
quite
Eric.
A while. Hi, Ken. How are you?
Yeah,
love
I'm good. I'm good.
I listen to it in archives all the time. This afternoon, I'm driving back to Iowa, by the way. And
there you
go. I thought I'd tune in on my iPhone here. Past the time. I do know the answer to your question. 9/11 is a significant date for Islam because that is the date that they had made the final push westward into Vienna, Austria. I believe the year was 1683. I might be wrong on the year, but I'm fairly certain that was the date. That
sounds like a winner to me, doesn't it, Kel?
Yes.
Sounds like a winner to me, Kel. What do you think?
Yep. Yeah, we got a winner.
Hey, did I have the year? What was the year?
Yeah, 1683.
Oh,
I remember
it
well.
That's right.
A history teacher for you.
In 1683, the Ottoman Turks attacked Vienna. The Turks viewed Vienna as the gateway to the hegemony over all of Western Europe. The resulting Battle of Vienna was a watershed moment in history. The Turks had made elaborate preparations and had assembled resources and jihadists eager for booty from throughout the Ottoman Empire. Europe was quite vulnerable, as it was fractured into warring kingdoms and weakened by intestine squabbles that nearly allowed Turks to conquer the European continent. However, the Turkish preparations were so elaborate that they could not be hidden, and the Europeans were able to form agreements or treaties to assist each other against the Turks that proved decisive, in which changed the course of human history. Eric, congratulations. You won yourself a grievance, mendacious mongering, a tequila artist coffee mug. Now, you stay on the line with me. I'm going to take you into the green room and get your details to get your mug mailed out to you, okay?
Okay. I also like to comment on the article that you're reading about.
Absolutely.
It's really interesting, and you're probably going to be surprised that I disagree with the idea of taking kids away from parents who have the potential to radicalize them. I'm not sure where Tim was going with his commentary on that, but I'm very certain that he realizes the dangers involved in there.
Yeah, I was going to elaborate on it, which I'll do in a little while. But yes, I take your point there, Eric, and I think it's a dangerous route to go down. Quite right, without question.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a famous scientist that I'm very familiar from your country, Tim, Richard Dawkins. He made the same claim about Christian children who are being taught about special creation and the God of the Bible creating the earth. And he's saying that children that are raised by these Christian, quote-unquote, fundamentalists should be categorized as children who are being abused by their parents because they're not being taught the theory of evolution and its application in the scientific classroom. And that alone sounds very similar to what this article is trying to say, is where you're singling out a specific sect of society, regardless of their intentions, regardless of what their political or religious ideology in this case, and taking them away from their parents and then making them ward for the state, which, you know, 9 times out of 10 is placing them in a much worse circumstance, creating certain potential for future life crime, substandard education and all those things that are coupled along with that. So I'm sort of saying, well, you're going to take them away because they might become terrorists. That's like saying, well, you know, let's go ahead and abort a baby because it might grow up to be a prisoner or something along those lines. I just think that's a very slippery slope to start traveling down.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and that's exactly where Tim was going. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, without a doubt. I don't think Boris had really engaged his brain when he started talking about this. What I was quite surprised about is that not that many people seem to have picked it up in the days following his pronouncement. I think maybe a lot of people thought, oh, that's just Boris, good old Boris, they thought, and paid no more attention to it. But I think it's a very serious point, and I think it's worthy of discussion. Eric, I don't agree that it's a route that we should be going down, but I think it's worthy of discussion because societies have gone down that route in the past. I'm thinking of the most recent on the run-up to World War II, where Jewish children were taken away from their parents because their Jewish parents were deemed to be unsuitable. And I think that if you start to do that on the basis of religion or philosophy or ideology, then, yeah, as you say, it's a very, very slippery slope. But I still think it's worth discussing because I think people should be aware of all the ramifications. And I think that's even more important given that we seem to have a great lack of interest in what Boris was actually saying. I'm not saying there was no interest at all, but I would have expected articles to appear in the mainstream media in the days following that announcement of Boris Johnson's. I would have expected lots of discussion in the media, and we just didn't seem to get it. And I thought it was such an important thing Because if people really thought that that was actually a possibility and that it was a route that we ought to be traveling down, we really ought to be bringing it out and explaining to people why it's actually not such a great idea at all. In fact, you've encapsulated it very well, Eric, and I was going to expand on it a little bit. But yes, you've made the point that you could, in going down that route, you could end up with a situation that was far worse than you had when you started.
And that's what I was driving at. Is when you try to fix a problem, normally what you do is you create ten other problems in the process, and I think that's what you would be doing there. Nobody's going to love their children or raise their children any better than the parents themselves, and regardless of what we see on TV and over to the parents that are abusive and, are neglectful. That's sensationalized in the news, of course, because that is the exception to the rule. That is not the rule, whereas when we look at the children, I'm a teacher, and I see children that are in foster homes and how inadequately they are actually cared for while under state custody like this. And it's scary thought when the state can start widening the scope of the criteria that they can use in order to take children out of a parent's custody like that, place them into an environment that is completely and demonstrated to be very destructive to their lives, to their self-esteem, and to their future. So, when we look at what little Vicky Dawkins had to say about, the evolution thing, there was, and they said boo, because why? Well, we're targeting Christians, which is always, the favorite target of the left. Well, when we start, I don't know who this first fellow is. He sounds a lot like a host on MSNBC in our country. Tongue in cheek said there anyway. So when we're talking about when people make these types of comments, they don't really realize, or when we start defending that type of criteria, they don't really realize, even though they have good intention, even though it sounds like a good idea, but, now they're going to talk about, well, we can't take them away from Islam or Muslim parents. They don't normally say that because they're afraid of getting their head cut off for criticizing Islam in any way, shape, or form. So it's good to hear somebody finally speak up about it, but it's sad to hear that they would speak up to it probably in under the wrong subject or wrong circumstance.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that is the path that we're taking. The reason why we brought this topic up is because Boris Johnson, he has, good intentions, but this is not the way to approach children being indoctrinated. This is the furthest thing that we want to do.
Yes, certainly. Now, do you want me to expand on that a little further for a couple of minutes while you talk to Eric in the green room?
Yeah, you know what? Tim, by all means, because I was just going to tell you, me and Eric, we're going into the green room together now.
Okay, fine. All right, well, just
thanks for your time,
Tim.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem at all, Eric, and I look forward to speaking to you again soon. So thank you for that. And you're really going to enjoy this coffee mug, I'll tell you. I'm looking at mine right now, and it's absolutely great.
It's going to be a great conversation starter. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Eric, thank you. And here we go.
All right, then. So just to recap on what Eric was saying, it is a dangerous route for any society to go down, just to take children away from their parents because of a religious position or a political position or a philosophical position. I think it is a slippery slope. And it has been tried before in other societies. And as I was just saying before Eric called, one of the most recent examples I can think of was in the 1930s and 40s, where Jewish children in Germany were taken away from their parents because their parents were scheduled for liquidation under Hitler's final solution. A lot of Jewish children were taken away and given to Aryan German parents. Now, I mean, quite apart from the fact that the Nazi philosophy was one of the biggest disasters of the 20th century, the actual concept of taking children away from their parents at all is a bad one, because no matter how flawed you might think the parents' philosophy is, or their religious ideals, or their political ideals, there's nothing in, well, I would say by and large, there is nothing better for a child than to have a stable family in which to grow up. And if you take a child out of that potential for a stable family and put them into something like foster care or any other kind of state institution, it is also almost certainly going to be worse for the child than if you had left them where they were. And to say that but it might be for the good of the state is really not an acceptable argument, in my view, in a civilized society. So I'm sure, as Kel said, when Boris came out with this idea back at the beginning of the month about taking children away from their parents if they look like they're becoming radicalized, well, we certainly have a problem with radicalization here in the UK, and I'm sure in pretty much every other Western country where large numbers of Muslims have been allowed to enter and to increase their populations and to form ghettos and so on, because as we know, they don't assimilate by and large. Some of them do, fine, but by and large, they don't assimilate, they don't integrate. And because Islam has a doctrine of warfare, eternal warfare against the non-believer, that's valid for all times and all places, then anybody who is brought up with Islam has the potential for radicalization, because Islam is a set of ideas that is completely against all notions of Western civilization and parliamentary democracy, and no matter what Muslims may tell you. As we know, Muslims tend to say, when they're questioned about Islam, but Islam is a religion of peace. It's benign and it's tolerant, and it's totally compatible with Western civilization and democracy, and you've got nothing to worry about, kuffar. But of course, because of the doctrine of taqiyya, which means they lie routinely to non-Muslims if the honour of Islam is at stake, you cannot take that what they say for granted. And indeed, when they tell you that Islam is a benign and tolerant religion of peace, they are lying to you. They're lying to all of us, and they have done ever since Islam was formed. But nevertheless, if we're talking about what to do about radicalisation, it's obvious to me that something has to be done, and if we don't follow Boris Johnson's suggestion and take children away from their parents, well, I think the idea of the rest of this program is to explore other ways in which radicalization can be tackled without actually removing children from their environment as they're growing up. I'm just going to check to see if we've got Kel back there. Yes, have we got you back yet, Kel? No, it doesn't sound like it. I'll expand a little bit on my ideas on that. I think it comes back primarily to education, and I think we in the West have a right to call on Muslims to look at the way they are going about things with bringing their children up. And we have a right to say that if you are going to live in our Western societies, we expect certain things. We shouldn't disagree, or we shouldn't discriminate against Muslims who assimilate to our way of doing things, who integrate into our societies, but there is a responsibility on Muslims to do certain things to make sure that their children have the best chance of assimilating and integrating to our societies. And is that Kel that I've just heard come back?
I am back.
Okay, good. What I was doing, Kel, while you were away, I was just saying that although it might not necessarily be a good idea to take children away from their parents because of the potential for radicalization, there are other things that we might do. And I had just started on talking about education and asking Muslims in the West to develop a sense of responsibility in order to give their children the best chance of assimilation and integration into our societies, because we know mm-hmm. that Islam does have a doctrine of warfare against non-believers. That is problematic. We know that Islam has a doctrine of taqiyya, which means that they lie to Muslims about everything that's bad about Islam, so that if you don't know very much about Islam and you, all you do is talk to Muslims, you'll come away with a favorable impression that is quite wrong and completely at odds with reality. So I think it's fair to ask Muslims in the first instance that if they wish to become assimilated and integrated with our society, we expect certain things from them. And what I was going to do was to go through a list, which I'll let you do, Kel. Robert Spencer of Jihad Watch actually put together a list of things that Muslims might do in order to become integrated and assimilated in the West, and indeed to allay suspicions of Islamophobia throughout the world, because of course Muslims are always complaining about how Islamophobic we non-Muslims are, how we're always, for no reason at all, we're always picking on Muslims, making them feel bad, making them feel unwanted. Well, Robert Spencer has got the perfect answer for all those Muslims who don't want to be the victims of Islamophobia. We have the perfect solution, or rather Robert Spencer does, and we were going to explore that as part of the anti-radicalization program that we might put together if we don't use Boris Johnson's rather extreme idea. So over to you with that one, Kel.
Yeah, this article is really quite fascinating. And, of course, this is from Robert Spencer of Jihad Watch. And this was premised around a Dallas Muslim group to hold a K-5 walk against Islamophobia, right, Tim? And they,
well, it was. I mean, he actually brought up the list in a slightly more abbreviated form some years previously, but the Dallas group that organized a walk against Islamophobia, where this list appears again, that seemed like a good idea, a good opportunity to bring up the list and to discuss it and say, well, look, you wouldn't need that walk against Islamophobia if only Muslims did this list of things.
Exactly.
So yes.
I was just reading the Unleashed Generations mission statement, though, their purpose and vision to expand the global humanitarian community, increase the Muslim presence in the global humanitarian community, foster insightful and intellectual generations starting with Muslims. And, you know, it all sounds very nice and good, and I do get a thumbs up for effort, but it all sounds very kumbaya to me. And what Robert Spencer came up with was what Robert Spencer said, essentially, that if Unleash really wants to end Islamophobia, there's a few ways they can go about it. And they can call upon Muslim individuals and groups to end Robert Spencer's list. One, focus their indignation on Muslims committing violent acts in the name of Islam, not on non-Muslims reporting on these acts. Number two, renounce definitively, sincerely, honestly, and in deeds, not just in comforting words, not just terrorism, but in any intention to replace Western constitutions or the constitutions of any non-Muslim state with Sharia, even by peaceful means. In line with this, clarify what is meant by their condemnations of the killing of innocent people by stating unequivocally that non-Muslim civilians, including Israelis, are innocent people, teaching accordingly in mosques, in Islamic schools, and behaving in accord with these new teachings. Number three, teach again, sincerely and honestly, in transparent and verifiable ways in mosques and Islamic schools, the imperative of Muslims coexisting peacefully as equals with non-Muslims on an indefinite basis and act accordingly. And four, begin comprehensive international programs in mosques all over the world to teach sincerely
against the understanding of Islam that gives rise to violent jihad and Islamic supremacism, offering honest reinterpretations of the text from the Quran and the Hadith that jihad is used to justify that violence and supremacism, rejecting firmly, clearly, definitively, and absolutely the literal meaning of those texts. This must also be accompanied by a rejection of all the teaching of Islamic jurisprudence calling for warfare against unbelievers for the purpose of subjugating them under Sharia rule. 5. Actively and honestly work with Western law enforcement officials to identify and apprehend jihadists within Western Muslim communities. And 6. Reject and teach and work against the aspects of Sharia that are at variance with accepted principles of human rights, the death penalty for apostasy, the death penalty for blasphemy and heresy, the stoning of adulterers, the amputation of thieves' hands, the denial of women's rights to testify and their equal inheritance rights, the divine sanction of the beating of women, the denial of basic rights to women and non-Muslims, etc. And you know what? And I like what he said here. If unleashed, did these 6 things, voila, Islamophobia would vanish and no walk against Islamophobia would be necessary. There you go, Tim.
Yes. Well, yes. I mean, this is something I've actually posted on my Twitter timeline on many occasions. I've put it out there for people to have a look at and to say, well, to invite comments. And the comments I get back are invariably along the lines are, isn't it going to be slightly difficult to get Muslims to do this? And I'm like, oh, really? Because, of course, the list which Robert Spencer has put together, you know, very commendable. And if everybody was as reasonable as we are, that is to say you and I, Kel, and the people listening in our chat room tonight, and, you know, people like Robert Spencer who really genuinely want to see a peaceful world where we all coexist as equals indefinitely, that list would be absolutely fine if we could just say, ah, here you go, Muslims, we've got a list for you. If you could implement it by this time next Tuesday, if you would be so kind, then I think the world would be a better place. But of course, when you go through that list, you realize that Muslims are actually going to find it quite difficult to follow the reasonable edicts on that list because they run completely counter to Islamic teachings. And this is the point that Robert Spencer is making, that although we might ask them to do this and into non-Muslim eyes, that list appears perfectly reasonable. But when a Muslim looks at it, he's going to say, but, you know, our teachings tell us that the kuffar is there only to be made war on and to be defeated and to be subjugated and to be killed and to, you know, if we don't kill them, we have to subjugate them and get them to pay the jizya. And that's if they don't convert to Islam. You know, we cannot teach them. We cannot teach other Muslims to treat them as equals in perpetuity. And I mean, that is the whole premise of this list that Robert Spencer has put together, mm-hmm. is that Muslims are going to be unable to do this because of the teachings of Islam. But of course, Muslims, when they're presented with a list like that, they have a problem because they want to tell the rest of the world that Islam is a benign and tolerant and peaceful religion. On the other hand, they don't want to. They want to have their cake and eat it. They want to tell non-Muslims that everything is nice and cuddly and fluffy with Islam, and there's nothing for us kuffar to worry about. And on the other hand, they want to continue teaching the eternal doctrine of warfare to other Muslims, so that other Muslims keep getting the message and keep killing non-Muslims in the name of Islam all around the world, carry on as they have been doing. And of course, this is what gives rise to the cognitive dissonance that all experience when Muslims tell us about how nice and cuddly and fluffy Islam is and how it's totally compatible with Western civilization. Who are you going to believe, kuffar, me or your lying eyes? And we're thinking, well, on the one hand, this Muslim saying it's all nice and you know, we've got nothing to worry about. And on the other hand, Muslims are slaughtering their way around the world, hundreds of people being killed in the most horrible ways possible by Muslims in the name of Islam every day of the week. And the reason that we have the cognitive dissonance, of course, is because Muslims are lying to us. Islam is not a benign and tolerant religion of peace. It is a political ideology, ruthless and violent at the core, and it only progresses through fear, violence, intimidation and terror as a political ideology, hiding behind a cloak of religion with an agenda of world domination through totalitarian means. And if we do not recognize that this is what it is, we are never going to defeat it. But the, Robert Spencer's list is a very clever list insofar as it shows what Muslims ought to be doing if they want to get rid of all the accusations of Islamophobia. But Muslims don't really want to do that at all. They complain about Islamophobia, but they don't have any intention at all of doing anything about it. They're just going to blame it on the kuffar being racist, bigoted, hateful, and intolerant. Oh, I missed out fascist as well, and Islamophobic. But
oh, you're slow today.
Yeah, no, that goes with the territory. They would rather blame the kuffar than do anything about it themselves to solve the problem. They don't want to solve the problem. What they want to do is for them to be able to keep on slaughtering and subjugating the kuffar until they have controlled the whole world, and they don't want the kuffar to notice that that is what they are doing. But sooner or later, the kuffar will notice, and we are beginning to notice, and we are beginning to draw people's attention to the cognitive dissonance and the reasons behind it. And this is a really good list. And if we look at specifically the items that refer to radicalization, I'm looking at item 3, where it says, teach in transparent and verifiable ways in mosques and Islamic schools the imperative of Muslims coexisting peacefully as equals with non-Muslims on an indefinite basis and act accordingly. Now, that's just one item out of the six, but it effectively, if it were implemented, it would mean an end to radicalization being taught in mosques and madrasas and Islamic schools. Now, are Muslims going to do that on their own? I think not. And if you also, if you look through the other items in the list, they are all things where in a sane world where everybody wanted to coexist peacefully together, these items are, they're perfect things for Muslims to do in order to rid themselves of the being victims of Islamophobia and to enable them to become citizens of our peaceful and enlightened democracies and to integrate and assimilate in ways which make them productive people rather than the slaughtering barbaric savages that they tend to turn into whenever anybody says no to them at the moment. So
absolutely.
Go on.
No, absolutely. I totally agree with everything you're saying. I mean, I know sometimes we may be boring to our listeners because we unequivocally agree all the time.
Oh, Kel, but you're never boring.
But the thing is that they have to take responsibility, and this is something we've been saying, and Boris Johnson's approach is not one that we should be taking. We can't go around and, you know, rounding up children of Muslim families. That's not the approach. No, the approach is to educate from the top down, and that includes the imams in the madrasas and in the mosques. We have to address the Middle Eastern leaders. We have to address the UN. We have to start from the top down. It's a trickle down effect. That's the only way it's going to work. What Boris Johnson is proposing is that we start bottom up, and that's only going to create a whole fall of wax that we're not quite ready to deal with, nor do we want to. And we're not going to go around the streets of London and rounding up Islamic children, ladies and gentlemen. That's not the approach to take. And when Boris Johnson speaks this way, all he does is he inflames the hatred of the Islamists, not the Muslim, but the Islamists, and he creates all sorts of tensions between the kuffar and the Islamists. That will only get worse. Can you imagine him if a dad came home from work? Maybe he's a taxi driver or a doctor, and he comes home from work, and his wife is there, and she's crying, and he's like, "What's going on?" The authorities came, and they took Muhammad. "What do you mean?" "Well, they thought we were radicalizing him." What are you talking about?" "Well, he was just learning his teachings in the Quran." "And they took him away." "Yeah, they took him away because they thought that we were radicalizing him." "Well, in a way, I can kind of see that because the Quran is a big piece of shit anyway." But these are, for the most part, pretty benign people that are just trying to get by and get on with life, and they're not interested in the jihad, the kinetic jihad, the violent jihad, as it were. They're not interested in that. They just want to coexist and get on with their lives and be left alone. So Boris Johnson's approach, this is what he would contribute to. All of a sudden, the benign Muslim becomes a radical jihadist.
Mm. Well, this is what I was saying about if we could actually have Islam classified as a political ideology rather than a religion, we could say to Muslims, you will not impose Islam in the public space. As a political ideology, we absolutely forbid it. Now, there is actually a precedent for this, and that just after the Second World War, the occupying American forces in Japan did exactly that with Shinto. They said to the Japanese citizens, you will not be allowed to impose Shinto in the public space, because Shinto had a political component in its ideology, not too dissimilar to Islam. And when when Japan was defeated at the end of the Second World War, that's exactly what the Americans did. They said, you can practice Shinto as a personal and private religion in your own home, in your own way. That's absolutely fine, but you will not be allowed to impose it in the public space in any way, shape, or form. Now, if we were to reclassify Islam as a political ideology, which I think we should, I think there should be a concerted effort to do that, and I'll go into that maybe later if we have time, an awful lot of things would fall into place. Parents would be permitted to teach Islam as a personal and private faith to their children, and to worship Allah in their own way, in their own personal and private space. It doesn't matter to us if they pray to Allah 5 times a day or 50 times a day. That is none of our business. It's only when Islam finds its way into the public space that we have a problem. And if that is absolutely forbidden, as I believe it ought to be, and when I say forbidden, I mean absolutely with an iron hand, there should be draconian penalties for the any sign of Islam in the public space at all, anywhere, in the same way that was done with Shinto in Japan in 1945, then I think we could solve a lot of these problems. I'm not saying that there wouldn't be a bit of a backlash. I'm sure there would be. But we could cope with it far more easily now than looking ahead 15, 20 years down the line and trying to find a solution at that time.
Yeah, and Bigfoot just brought up a really good point in the chat room. We also force the Emperor of Japan to renounce his alleged divinity. And if anybody ever saw that movie, The Last Emperor, you will get a lot of great history out of that one. And you can read the book as well. That is fascinating, Tim, and that is what we have to do. We have to knock down the divinity of Muhammad, because he was not divine. He was a mortal who was clinically insane, and he came across this imaginary angel that whispered imaginary things in his ears that he believed to be real. And that if we can make people understand that Islam was not born of a divine entity, such as Judaism and Christianity, for example, then we could turn it on its ear. We have to have the will, and we have to have the powers that be, though, to back us up. People like Boris Johnson are not the ones that should be speaking on our behalf. If we want a reformation, we need higher powers than Boris Johnson and you and myself, for example.
Well, that's certainly true. I think that it's certainly something that needs to be pursued, though, because without renouncing Islam as a religion, we are going to find it very difficult to take any kind of effective steps at all, because we have said as part of our constitution, and well, various Western countries have said it in different ways, but we in the Western democracies have committed ourselves to allowing the free exercise of religion. And if you're talking about something that's practiced in a personal and private way, I don't see any problem with that. The problem comes when that personal and private religion transmogrifies into a political ideology that starts usurping the public space. And that's exactly the problem we have with Islam. If we could get rid of that, then an awful lot of things would fall into place that we can't deal with easily at the moment, because Islam has religious protections that are not justified. We take away those religious protections and we say that ideology is going to be treated in the same way, the political ideology side of it is going to be treated in the same way that we would treat Nazism. If we had an upsurge of Nazism right now, we would stamp on it very hard, and indeed done when we've seen neo-Nazis in the public space around the world in Western democracies. We've tended to stamp down quite hard on that, and quite rightly too. And I think if we took that approach with Islam and said, you are not going to be allowed to practice the political ideology of Islam in the public space in any way, shape or form, we, as I say, there might be a backlash, but nevertheless, we could then find a way forward that has been eluding us for so long, mm-hmm. because we've tended to treat Islam as a religion. Now, on that subject, there was actually an effort some 50, 60 years ago, and I'm going to have to research it a bit more. Although I can briefly talk about this subject, I haven't done the level of research that I would like to do before I bring it onto a show like this one, and that's to do with the Calcutta petition around about 50 or 60 years ago, I believe. Somebody in India wanted to do a very similar thing. They wanted to bring to the attention of the Indian authorities the fact that the Quran was a violent and hateful manual that incited violence against non-Muslims. This was recognized in India a long time ago, and the founders of the Calcutta Quran Petition, I think to give it its full name, actually petitioned the Indian judiciary to come to a ruling which would effectively have had the same effect by taking the political aspect of Islam out and turning Islam into purely a personal and private thing. It was not agreed to by the Indian judge that it was presented to at that time, and it never got any further. And I dare say the judge took one look at it and thought, if I agree to this, I'm going to be mincemeat by this time tomorrow morning. So I'm sure that there was a certain aspect of fear involved by the Indian judiciary, and that's why it never got any further than it did. And perhaps we'll see the same thing over here. If we were to put together a petition to demand that Islam be treated as a political ideology, then I'm sure we would run up against a similar problem, in that the people who could make those decisions now might well decide that discretion is the better part of valor and throw it back because they didn't want to lose their heads. But if we don't do it, this is the point to be made, that if we don't do something like that now, we are going to be visiting civil war on our children and grandchildren in the not too distant future. So it's the lesser of two evils, in my view. And I think we should do whatever we can to persuade the authorities that it is in fact the lesser of two evils, and that they should grasp the nettle and turn Islam into a or have it converted to a political ideology for all intents and purposes, so that we can then control and constrain it in the same way that we would control and constrain Nazism.
Oh, exactly. And the Calcutta petition, of course, it got nowhere, unfortunately, when Chakraborty, he filed a writ with his petition at the High Court. And when did he do that? On March 16th of 1985. And I just put a wiki link in the chat room for everybody to follow along. But it didn't go anywhere, which is a shocking place in India, of all places. You would think that India, of all places, would have such an influence in that they would be the most eager country outside of Israel at that point to see the Quran banned as hate literature and de-indexed. I'm surprised that India never went along with this petition. I'm shocked by that.
Yes, I mean, when I said it was exactly the same thing as I was proposing, I wasn't quite right there. The Quran petition was primarily in order to ban the Quran, because it's full of hate speech, and I would argue that it is primarily a political text. If you look at, if you actually analyse the Quran and see how it is made up, most of the Quran is not to do with how to become a better person, how to achieve spiritual enlightenment, how to conduct yourself in a way that will improve your own personal life and your relationship with your God during that life. Most of the Quran, 64% of it to be precise, tells Muslims how they should deal with the kuffar, not how to become a better person or to achieve spiritual enlightenment. And for that reason, I think there's a very good case to be made for saying the Quran is a political text. Now, I don't know that I would necessarily go as far as banning it. The reason for that is I'm just generally not in favor of banning books at all, because for one thing, it's counterproductive. If you ban a book, people don't get rid of the book. They just hide it where you can't find it, and then they teach it undercover to anybody who wants to learn about it. And the very fact that it's a banned book makes it more attractive. So I don't know that I would do that, but I think that declaring Islam as a political ideology would have a much more beneficial effect, and I think we should definitely try and pursue it.
And on that note, we're going to take a break. And I want to play something here, Tim. I was going to call for an early break, but you were on such a roll, I didn't want to interrupt you. But I want to play a song. It's 6 minutes long, but I don't want you guys to run off into the kitchen, and that includes you, Tim. I want everybody to try to listen to this song and listen to the words very, very carefully. Like I say, it's 6 minutes long, but it's almost like a documentary. And this is The Future by Leonard Cohen. We're going to see everybody, though, back here in 6 minutes.
Give me absolute control over everything. stop. You feel the devil's riding crop. Get ready for the future. It is murder.
When Leonard Cohen penned that song, he had something else completely different in mind. But if you listen to the lyrics, I'm sure you know where you can apply it today. And ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Red Fox Blogger with your host, Kel Fritzy and Tim Burton. And we want to thank everybody who is joining us. First of all, of course, the host is Tim and myself. We want to thank Eric from Iowa joining us in the studio, and he's going to be back on the line momentarily. But in the chat room, we have Anna, we have Bigfoot, Dodgy Dave, Jeff of English Defense League, Eric Kyle, numerous guests, Luchadora, Vito Esposito, and Zach Paisley. Thank you all for taking time out of your otherwise busy days to spend time with ours. And we also want to thank everybody who listens in archive. And what did you think, Tim, of that song?
Yeah. I was just thinking about the lyrics of that Leonard Cohen song. I mean, Leonard Cohen, he's been going around a while, isn't it? He's still alive. I am right in saying he is still alive, isn't he?
Oh, yeah. He lives down the street from me.
Oh, yes, that's right. I remember you saying now. And when I was at university, well, many years ago now, my roommate, he was one of my roommate's favourite singers, and he was into singing very melancholy songs at that time. And I used to say, Rick, pack it in. You're just driving me absolutely nuts, you know. I'm so depressed listening to Leonard Cohen. But he was very prophetic in what he wrote, and the lyrics of that tune, as you say, I'm sure he didn't have Islam in mind in particular when he wrote that tune. Well, maybe he did, I don't know. But
yeah.
A lot of what he wrote, you know, you can look at it now and you could think, yeah, those circumstances weren't necessarily applicable at the time he wrote his song, but isn't it wonderful how well the lyrics have traveled and how applicable they are to today's political environment that we find ourselves in. So yeah, most interesting from that point of view. Most interesting. I like his Hallelujah that Bigfoot was talking about. I've had a go at recording that on MP3 myself with my guitar and my singing, but I'm told, reliably told, by our in-house music critic that it's crap. So I'm not going to be broadcasting it to our listeners tonight. Leonard Cohen is a musician.
He's wonderful. My mum met him a number of years back because she's a huge fan, and that CD of his, The Future, I recommend that CD to everybody. But yeah, he is quite, I've never met him, but he's apparently quite the engaging fella in that you just show up at his house and he'll say, oh, come on in, let's have a tea together and have a sit down. Like, that's just the type of person he is. And to see him perform, I wish that I think he had his encore tour about a year ago, and I wish that we tried to get tickets, but they were sold out, of course, because, you know, it's Leonard Cohen. And but to see the CD of his one of his concerts, it's magic. He's absolutely fantastic. But yeah, I thought that song was absolutely maybe it was prescient on his part. I don't know. Same way with J.R.R. Tolkien in Lord of the Rings. Who knows?
Well, yeah, quite. And I mean, that's another author that, of course, when that book was written back in the 1930s with the Hobbit and Lord of the Rings, I'm sure J.R.R. Tolkien didn't have Islam in mind when he wrote it. But you see so many parallels with the fight of good against evil and the characteristics of the orcs. And you think, you know, he's talking about Muslims here when he describes these orcs. And he's just another very prescient, I should say, author, in the same way that Leonard Cohen was a prescient composer and musician. But yes, that's a good example.
Oh, yeah. And we have Eric joining us again. And Eric had some bullet points that he wanted to share with us on the topic before the break. Hey, Eric, welcome back.
Hi, Cal. I had actually gone into, I'd hung up and then gone into listening on the internet, on Blog Talk Radio, and then Tim started talking about that banning Islam and classifying it as a political ideology. And it automatically made me want to turn around and get off the internet and then call back in and start asking some specific questions about that, because when we start talking about banning practices, period, that's when, you know, these antennas go up and alarm bells start going off. And Tim did a good job qualifying that after I called back in and outlining some of the dangers, if you could classify them as doing something like that. But I did have a question about Tim, were you talking about banning it specifically in England, or that should be any country that it is allowed to be practiced in?
Well, living in England as I do, and the authorities are starting to say little things about the radicalisation of Muslim children, like Boris Johnson did. And we've had one or two people say some things which makes me think that we're starting to recognize the problem to a limited extent. But I don't think any of our authorities are prepared to take the steps that I think ought to be taken in order to deal with this properly. So, I mean, primarily, I'm looking at it from how would it be if we took those steps in England in particular. I personally think that given that Islam manifests itself in very similar ways in Western democracies all around the world, and Western democracies have similar problems which they're all trying to deal with in their own way. But if you take a global picture, what you see in Western democracies around the world are problems that are very similar, whether they're in the UK, in Europe, in America, in Canada, or in Australia, or any other Western democracy where we have a growing and aggressive population of Muslims. I think that if we could have this particular course of action implemented in every Western democracy, if we could do it blanket worldwide all at the same time by this time next Tuesday, I think it would be absolutely great. Now, I realize that there are practical or rather impractical things that would need to be overcome before that actually happens, but nevertheless, I think that the banning of any manifestation of Islam in the public sphere would be a good thing for every Western democracy. And as I said, I'm not talking about banning the personal and private practice of the religious aspect of Islam, which people might want to pursue in their own home, okay? Because we just can't have control over that. If somebody wants to teach their children things in their own home, there is no practical way we can easily control that, apart from deporting every Muslim lock, stock and barrel. And while certain people have proposed this as being a valid course of action, I think that we ought to be trying other things first. And if we can just recognize that Islam is first and foremost a political ideology and ban its practice in the public space, and I think we could do that in pretty much the same way in every Western democracy throughout the world, because the characteristics of Western type democracies are very similar throughout the world, not necessarily identical, but they have a high correlation with a high similarity between them. And the problems that we have with Islam also have a very high correlation, very high similarity, depending on how many Muslims there are in percentage terms in the population. I think we should propose it as a worldwide solution and not necessarily something just for the UK.
I think that sounds, excuse me for saying this, but I think that sounds like a very dangerous proposition. And here's why. When our country was founded and the Bill of Rights was written, and specifically in the First Amendment, Congress would make no law or write no laws respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the practice thereof, this is where, in the United States, specifically, and I'm not necessarily sure what the English Bill of Rights would say about it, but in the United States, that would be almost an impossibility. Plus, on top of that, this is what the secularization of our government. Our secularization of our government has gotten so extreme, where this is where we have pretty much banned the expression of any type of Christian belief in the public arena. And therefore, has resulted in the degradation not only of the government, at the ethics within our government. We'll see what they've done, but also you take that a step further and see what it's done to our society as a whole. Now, I'm not saying I think the best answer for this is to have an open, candid discussion with Muslims, with Islam, and debate this openly, because once the darkness of this, and this is just my thinking on this, and satanically inspired ideology is exposed for what it is, then and only then will people start leaving this religion and its practice. Because if you look all across the Muslim world, any type of criticism of Muhammad, Islam, is punishable by either imprisonment and or death. And when you start imposing that same type of criteria on that religion in the West, then what you've done is you've established a because Christianity, when it has grown the most, is when it's been persecuted. You know, we look at, you know, Christian growth across the country, or across the world. It is in those countries where it is persecuted. And when you start making martyrs out of these guys, when you start persecuting that religion, well, that makes it the forbidden fruit, and that will draw more people to.
Well,
the
I understand what you're saying there, but what I was trying to do was to draw a distinction between the personal and private practice of religion, which I don't think should be abrogated in any way, and the imposition of the political ideology, the political component of Islam in the public sphere. And if we could actually achieve that separation, then there is absolutely no reason that people can't be allowed to practice their religion privately in their own way. The problem we have is not with the private practice of religion. The problem we have is that the imposition of the political ideology in the public space is interfering with everybody else's rights.
If you're speaking specifically about Sharia, I wholeheartedly agree with you. To codify that, you know, when we look at like Dearborn, where they've already allowed some portion, judges have allowed some portions of Sharia to take effect in the private lives and private communities within Muslim community up there. Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree with that. But when you make if you're not going to make a distinction, like, well, you are making a distinction, but I'm saying making that distinction would be probably the toughest thing to do, because then you're opening the door to a whole new wide interpretation of what our Constitution here in the United States says. And, you know, the funny thing was, well, not so funny, but I mean, last summer I went to a demonstration down in Manchester, Tennessee, where we had a district attorney, or a United States attorney, Bill Killian, was
trying to use
American hate law legislation to persecute a guy for putting a post out on Facebook about, you know, this is how you should wink at a Muslim. Well, when you start doing that, I mean, this is where, you know, when we talk about that article, that starts down a slippery slope. I think Islam would be defeated more easily and readily defeated if it is exposed to what it is, and people are allowed to talk candidly and not have to tread so softly, especially in our media today, where you have to be careful of what you say about Islam, or you're going to be labeled as a bigot or a follower.
Eric, absolutely, and this is the thing that we have to defeat, and I'm interjecting because my ire is going up here. We have to start rejecting UN resolutions or OIC in particular, resolutions like 1618 that makes speaking about religion a hate crime, and you know that that's code speak for you cannot denigrate Islam.
Yeah, religion being Islam. That's exactly what they're talking about. They're not talking about, you know, criticizing Christ. They're not talking about criticizing Buddha. They're talking about criticizing Muhammad, because that's one of those cardinal sins within Islam. You get your head lopped off if you say, you know, Muhammad was an adulterer, slave trading, lying, thieving, pedophile. I mean, you can't say that in Islam without fear of death. Here in the United States, we can say that. As long as we don't put our name out there.
Yeah. I certainly think if we could develop an environment which meant that we could all talk about Islam freely, then that would be just as good a thing to do as well, because I take the view that if everybody understood the truth about Islam in the way that we understand it, by which I mean Al and myself, or the listeners here, if everybody really understood the truth, then Islam would crumble into dust. But of course, Muslims are not about to think a free and open discussion. We're still a long way away from the possibility of a free and open discussion. And therefore, I think that we are going to have to, as non-Muslims, we are going to have to impose a solution on Muslims that is going to meet the deteriorating national security situation that we see in all the Western democracies throughout the world. It's a national security threat that will mean the end of civilization, that is to say, our Judeo-Christian civilization, in all those Western countries that continue to allow the unrestrained and unconstrained encroachment of Islam that will result in the destruction of our civilizational model. And I don't see any reason why we should allow that to happen, because our civilizational model is infinitely better than their civilizational model. So if we have to do something, which whatever we do, I think is going to be difficult to implement it. If it was easy, it could have been done 1,000 years ago, but it's not going to be easy. And we are going to have to take steps which are going to be unpleasant, which are going to be unpopular. And if the only thing I can say about that is, if we do not take those steps, then things are going to be infinitely more unpleasant in the next 15, 20 years or in the lifetimes of our children and grandchildren. So unpleasant though it may be, and difficult though it may be to implement it, in whether it's in the UK or in America or in any other Western democracy, I think we all have to do our best to try, because the alternative is 1,000 times worse.
Well, when we start talking about a shooting, you know, when we stop talking, that's when people start shooting. So I agree wholeheartedly. So, you know, if there's ways to illuminate the problem within Islam itself without shutting down the discussion, meaning that, you know, the easiest way to shut down a discussion, call the person that you disagree with or a debate a bigot or a racist. And that's what Muslims do. People have to have the courage, not only the intellectual courage, but also the moral courage, to stand up and say, no, this is not about bigotry. This is not about racism. This is not about your made-up idea of, you know, Islamophobia. This is about the treatment of human beings. You know, when we look at the UN and how they're always, you know, touting the idea that they're always about, you know, humanitarianism. Well, here we go. You know, if you want to start talking about human beings are treated, look at the way human beings are treated in predominantly Islamic countries. The idea of individual liberties or individual rights is just absolutely foreign to them, because Islam means what? Submission. You submit and you keep your mouth shut. There's no ability to have an open discussion about it there. Here in the West, we have that ability to open things. This is why I was kind of a little queasy about, you know, saying, well, we should ban certain portions of this religion in the public sector. Well, the practice of Sharia, yeah, I agree with, but you have to first have that discussion to delineate between what is Sharia and what is religious within Islam. And I think that once that discussion is made and those points are illuminated for the public to digest, then nobody is going to have a problem at all with doing something like that.
Well, I think when we're talking about getting rid of Islam out of the public sphere, we're going to have to do far more than just ban the practice of Sharia law. I mean, in this country, in the UK, we have at least 85 Sharia courts at the last count, and probably more now, because I think that survey was done a couple of years ago. And at the moment, the British government is doing everything it can to encourage Sharia in terms of not only permitting Sharia courts to continue to operate, but also starting to introduce Islamic banking. And we've heard this week that the Law Society is talking about introducing Islamic wills and making effectively Sharia part of the British legal landscape. Well, yes, all that has to stop, but that isn't the only thing. We've got to treat Islam in the same way that we would treat the public espousal of Nazism. Now, that is to say, if you've got people in the public sector, you're going to have to screen them to see whether they support Islam in the same way that we would have screened people in the past to see if they support Nazism. Because if we have people who espouse views of that nature in our education systems, in our legal systems, in our local and national government, in the police, in the judiciary, all these areas in the military, if we have Islam popping in as part of the political environment in those areas, we're still going to be in trouble. So we have to remove it from those areas too. And of course, if you're looking in the United States, the obvious thing to do, the very first thing to do would be to purge the national government of everybody who has Islamic tendencies, because Obama himself has been filling up government with people who are sympathetic to imposing Sharia law throughout the country. And, you know, that would have to stop straight away in the United States if we had any sanity in the political landscape. But it is going to be much more than just banning the practice of Sharia law, I feel.
Well, when you were talking, I had an idea there that where if you're going to start banning people from holding public positions based on their religion, again, that in the United States is something that we can't do. I mean, if you look at our CIA director, my understanding is, from reading I've done, this guy is a Muslim convert. I'm not sure how much truth there is to that, but that's a scary.
That's the story, isn't it? I've heard that, and I haven't had it confirmed, but there is that rumor. Yeah, sorry, I was interrupting you. Please carry on.
No, and then the primary advisor to our president, Valerie Jarrett, she's Iranian, for Pete's sake. So, how does all that happen? You know, you look at the influence in our own government at the federal level, like you were saying. But then again, you start running into civil rights. Civil rights, if you make, you know, if you discriminate based on religion or religious preference, well, you can't do that in our country. I'm not sure if you could do that in England.
Well, this is what I was saying about having Islam reclassified as a political ideology. It's because we insist on treating it as a religion that we are running into so much trouble. If we were to say, first and foremost, it's a political ideology, therefore, if you follow this, if you voluntarily choose to subscribe to this political ideology, that is going to disqualify you from public office or from holding positions in local or national government, in education, in the police force, in the military, in our judiciary, right from the start. And it's because we've got it in our heads that Islam is a religion and therefore we can't touch it or we can't make any religious test. That problem completely goes away if we say Islam is not a religion. Islam is a political ideology first and foremost. If you want to practice some form of Islam in a personal and private way in your own home, you go right ahead. But you will not bring Islam in any way, shape or form our national institutions, and specifically government institutions, or like I said, the police, the military, the judiciary or education. And I think if we get that into our heads that it's not a religion, it's a political ideology first and foremost, we're going to go a long way towards solving these problems. But while we continue to say that Islam is primarily a religion, we are stuck. There is very little we can do because we have guaranteed freedom of religion. But we have to say Islam is not a religion. I mean, you've only got to look at Quran chapter 48, 29 to prove that. It does not follow the golden rule. And for that reason alone, you could declassify it as a religion and have it reclassified as a political ideology. Sorry, Kel, I'm interrupting.
No, I was just bringing up
I was just backing up what both you gentlemen have been saying, and I just am deferring to the chat room, and Agador brought up a really good point in that who cares about who the advisor is. When an ideology disguises itself as a religion, it's something we in the United States can take care of, for instance, in Article 5 Convention. And I did a Google search of the Article 5 of the United States Constitution, in which it states, Article 5 of the United States Constitution describes the process whereby the Constitution may be altered. Altering the Constitution consists of proposing an amendment or amendments and subsequent ratification. Amendments may be adopted and sent to the state for ratification by either two-thirds supermajority of both the Senate and House of Representatives to the United States Congress, or by a national convention assembled at the request of the legislatures of at least two-thirds, at present 34, of the United States. To become part of the Constitution, an amendment must be ratified by either, as determined by Congress, the legislatures of three-fourths, at present 38, of the states, or state ratifying conventions in three-fourths, at present 38, of the United States. And this is something that I brought up on EDR radio show with Agador and yourself, Tim, and Jeff, is that under the First Amendment in the United States, for example, and this is a great template to use, because the United States has a wonderful constitution, and I brought this up. Under the First Amendment, Islam is a protected religious status, and that they cannot be touched. The only way that we could de-index Islam as a religion is to amend the Constitution in the United States. I don't know what we would do in other countries, but the United States, if they could de-index Islam as a religion, we would have 50% of our battle won, I think.
Oh, yeah, probably more than 50%.
Tim made a very good point earlier, Kel, where he was talking about 64% of the Quran talks about how to deal with the kuffar, how to deal with the unbelievers. And Bill Warner has a wonderful website, I'm sure you're aware of it, Political Islam, where he actually is able to outline the percentages of the Quran, not only the Quran, but also the Hadith and Sunnah that talk about how to deal with people who are not believers. I mean, it's just a huge majority of their writing deal with the politics of the matter and how to subjugate people who are not believers. But the thing that you were talking about as far as the convention of the states, I think that what Agador was talking about was moving the discussion away from Washington, D.C., where things can be so politically one-sided, so politically charged, and use the second amendment process in Article 5 of the Constitution, where you bypass Congress and you have a convention of the states, but you have to have, I think it's three-quarters of the states would call Constitution conventions and pass an amendment that would classify Islam as a political ideology versus a religious philosophy. But the idea of that happening, and I think Tim has alluded to this, is almost impossible until you have this discussion first, or you get to the point where England has become, where you have such a huge problem within the country itself with Islam and Muslims as far as what they're doing there in the country and having, what did it say, over 100 different Sharia courts. And that was a question that I asked again, is why is England, even in the first place, allowing Muslims to do this?
Tim, take it away.
Well, as far as why is it happening, there's several possible answers, and I think probably the answer is a combination of factors. I certainly think there's a question of appeasement, and a lot of our politicians would rather not have a riot on their hands by taking decisions that are unpopular with Muslims, because as we know, when Muslims feel they're hard done by, they don't just sit down and write a letter to the local newspaper. They go in the kitchen, pick up the biggest machete they can find, and it's Allah Akbar all the way. They form mobs, they riot, they destroy property, and they kill people. So there's certainly appeasement and fear, which drives a lot of the decision-making that politicians make over here. And I imagine that it's pretty much true wherever you go in Western democracies. There are politicians at the top who think, well, I'm doing very nicely at the moment. Why should I upset my career by caring for such things as the long-term good of my country when I can just continue to line my pockets and then retire in a few years' time to a nice gated community somewhere in a nice warm country in the Caribbean and leave it for somebody else to solve. So that is certainly part of the problem. But then we've also got the Saudi petrodollar and the fact that if we upset the Islamic world too much, they do have the means of making our lives very uncomfortable through economic measures, if through nothing else. So there's that, and there's also the fact that large numbers of our politicians are dependent on the Muslim vote in order to stay in office. So self-interest certainly comes into it. Fear comes into it. Appeasement and dimitude certainly comes into it. Saudi petrodollar certainly comes into it. And I think the reason that we don't get things done in the way that we would all like them to be done is due to a combination of these factors and the fact that our political system is geared to short-term gains for politicians rather than the long-term national security of the country and the protection of the indigenous population. So that's the short answer. I can give you a longer answer later on if you like.
We have a lot of countries and the governments, they are so soaked in appeasement that it just makes my stomach roil. But in Canada, and Luchadora brought this up in the chat room, and I'm glad she did, in Canada we have a Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, and he is trying to address the issues of Islam within Canada. Whenever he makes proposals, whenever he makes amendments, he is slammed by the official opposition, which is the New Democratic Party, and he's slammed by the Liberals that have a few seats in Parliament as well in the House of Commons. But Stephen Harper knows the threat of Islam, and he's trying to do something about it within Canada. He's de-indexing special interest groups left, right, and center. He de-indexed the Council of the Islamic Congress in Canada here a few years back because they were just getting a little too feisty. He's got Muslims suing him right now, and he's not going to put up with that. He's going to de-index them next. But my biggest fear is that we don't have enough Stephen Harpers globally. And what's going to happen, we have our elections coming up next year. What frightens me is that the voting blocks are going to develop and we are going to lose our conservative majority. And if we do, we will lose Stephen Harper. We may end up with a conservative minority, but that would mean that he would need the cooperation of the House to pass up member bills, for example. He would have to have the vote. And I don't know if he's going to be capable of carrying that forth with a minority government. I want to ask you, Eric, when you see a minority government, how do you see you have the Congress and the House? Like, how do you see things going in your midterm elections come this year? Oh, hang on.
Have we still got Eric?
We do.
I'm here.
Hi,
hello.
Eric. Sorry about that.
Hello. That's all right. From what I've read, it looks like the Republicans are going to be able to take back the Senate if they can keep this Obamacare issue front and center with the public. So, and they're going to hold the House. That's from what I've read, from what I've heard. But even with that said, some of the, you know, I don't want to say that that's necessarily the best thing, but it would definitely be a good thing if, you know, to put an extra stop in Obama running roughshod over the Constitution like he has been, saying that he's going to rule by executive orders, bypass the Constitution. You know, that's just insane. Even, you know, somebody that sits in one of my classes when we talk about the Constitution is able to recognize the innate problems of allowing an executive to write law or legislate and to execute those laws. That's just a scary thing. So having the Republicans win the Senate would be a good thing. But then again, having the majority leader be Mitch McConnell will be a scary thing, because the guy is about as feckless as John Boehner is. They are political cowards, just like Tim was saying, that you have politicians there in England that are afraid to stand up, fear of being labeled or not getting a certain constituency to vote for them, or maybe be fearful of OPEC shutting down the supply of cheap oil. You know, you have all those variables. But when you look at our Congress and the Republican leadership, you know, I used to be a registered Republican. I have stopped giving them people a penny of my money simply because of their political cowardice. Boehner needs to get his head out of his fourth point of contact and start standing up to this guy and start talking about things that the American people, specifically when we start talking about Obamacare, absolutely don't want. And he has a winning – this is how inept the guy is. I mean, he has a winning subject here that you have over 65-70% of the American people. We don't want Obamacare in its current form. But yet he is afraid to take a stand on that when we start talking about, you know, the responsibilities of Congress as far as funding is concerned. That whole shutdown in October, that was, to me, the most idiotic thing that I have seen Boehner do, or any Speaker of the House, to do by giving in to Obama on that, when everybody clearly didn't want it. And it was only a week after that, if we remember what happened, that it came out that they were having all kinds of programs with the rollout of registration on that. It's just amazing. So, you know, to say that the Republicans, you know, stemming Obama's imperial presidency, or however you want to categorize it, I don't think that's going to happen, even if we do win back the Senate.
I am really, really hoping, though, that the by-elections this year go very well, Eric, because I always say this, as America goes, so does the rest of us. But I will emphasize that I always say that we really need strong governments, and we rely on the United States, and we rely on the United Kingdom to take a torch and get us out of this mess. We're in a mess all over the place, but, of course, the biggest threat we face not even socially, but in social policy in particular, is that of Islam, in that Islam just won a battle this week, and that Sharia-compliant courts are making a beachhead again in the UK, Tim, and that frightens me.
We have
so far dodged court officialdom here in Canada, but we still have Sharia-compliant policies, and, for example, prayers, Friday afternoon prayers allowed in our public schools. But the United States, you're also seeing Sharia-compliant courts being set up there. We need very strong governments. We need backbone. We need people to take care of us, because if our governments fail us, then we're gone. That's it. It's over.
You know,
well,
I would probably start a separate discussion on this, but when our country starts moving toward secularization, moving away from our founding principles, the Judeo-Christian value system that our country was founded upon, and being afraid to talk about in the public arena, exercising or exhibiting those values, that's why we're having the problems that we are today. This is what has resulted in the election of President Obama. This is what has resulted in the trillion-dollar deficit that we're running here. This is what has resulted in the $40 billion-plus just being put into existence from the Federal Reserve on a monthly basis. Is when we lose those values, when we don't practice those Christian values of what government should be, it should not be the be-all, end-all for everybody like it's trying to be. It should be it should be set up to where, like our founding fathers wanted it, as outlined in the Federalist Papers. It should be limited in its scope and its ability, and it should not be interfering in with the laws of the state. And if you look at the Tenth Amendment, that's exactly why that's there.
I'm going to give Tim the last word with your conversation with you, Eric. We are down to the wire, and we're going to be closing out in a moment. But, Tim, I would like you to address that.
Yes, well, I mean, I agree with everything you're saying, and you were talking specifically, you and Kel were talking specifically about America and Canada. And, yeah, again, we are constrained somewhat by the nature of the democratic system we have over here. And, of course, if a few more years go by and nothing changes, we're going to find it correspondingly difficult to get the things done that need to be done because of the nature of the democratic system. And that's one of the things that we have with a democratic system. It's all well and good most of the time, but when you get a situation like that, it does have a fundamental flaw. And the fundamental flaw is that the more people that are allowed to come into the country and make up a percentage of the voting population, the less chance that we as conservative common sense people have to turn it around. And I'm sure that's what left-wing governments all over the world rely on. If you can't change the policies, then just change the population. And the large-scale immigration of people into Western democracies, I'm sure, is a cynical ploy by left-wing governments to make sure they stay in power. So we're all up against it at the moment. We're finding it harder and harder to maintain the opportunities of keeping conservative governments in power, because there's a natural bias, of course, for immigrants who come in to vote from the people who are going to give them the most money. So maybe we've got to change fundamental things about our democracy in order to get back to a point where it's more stable and less likely to be influenced by these sort of corrupt practices by left-wing politicians. But that's just a general observation. I don't have a specific answer to that tonight, and we are on the run-up to the last few minutes of the show. I would like to say, if there was one thing about our democratic system I'd like to see, or two things rather, it would be making voting compulsory, as Eric Kyle has mentioned in the chat room, and also getting rid of postal voting, which has made the electoral system open to fraud. I think we need really to do those two things and reintroduce some confidence back into the electoral system. But other than that, I'll hand the mic back to Kel and let her wind the show up for tonight.
Eric, I want to thank you so much for calling in. It has been wonderful to hear your voice, and I hope you're not driving while you're talking.
No, I am, as a matter of fact.
Bad man.
I got the hands-free device there where I got both hands
up. Oh, there you go. Okay, that's fine then. That's fine.
Okay. And I'm
but get back home safe.
I will. Thank
you. Yeah. Thank you, Eric, so very much. Have a wonderful weekend. We'll talk again soon.
You bet, you, Kel.
Yeah, goodbye. Goodbye, Eric.
And with that was Eric from Iowa joining us on the line, and a wonderful conversation it was. And, Tim, I want to thank you for picking up the slack on that, because I was having audio issues and I was having trouble hearing. I was probably repeating a few things. I hope I didn't, but I do tend to do that. But, hey. Oh, boy. But you know what? Yeah, we're down to the wire. So what you think? Pretty good, eh?
Pretty damn good, Kel. I put it all down to having a fantastic co-host and producer in Kel Fritzy. And I shouldn't really do this, but she does a wonderful job producing not only this show, but a whole bunch of other shows, which are too many for me to mention. And she really does deserve a round of applause for handling all that in the professional way that she does. So come on, guys, let's hear it for Kel Fritzy. Yay!
Come on, guys. Where's my applause? Come on. Hey, you guys,
it's gotta
are
be there.
Out there.
Gotta
oh,
be there.
Hang
somewhere.
On. You know. Oh, there they are. They're. Oh, what they're doing, Tim, is they're just getting their pom poms together. That's what they're doing. crazy. But thanks, Tim. That is awesome. And let me see. What are we up to tomorrow night there, Tim?
Well,
are we up to no good again?
We're up to no good, Kel. We're up to no good. And after that, we've got a radio show. Oh, no, I've given let the cat out of the bag there, didn't I, Kel? Sorry about that. Yeah, tomorrow night, we've got Freedom Loving Infidels, part of the Radio Jihad Network. And that's on at 10 o'clock GMT, which I think is 6 o'clock Eastern Time over in your part of the world. And Kel and myself will be interviewing Robert Spencer from Jihad Watch, which is somebody that I'm pretty sure some of our listeners may well have heard of. So please listen to Freedom Loving Infidels on the Radio Jihad Network tomorrow evening, folks.
And everybody, thank you once again for joining Tim and myself. Believe me, we would not do this program without the support of you. Well, we probably would, but, you know, because Tim and I, we just like talking anyway. Can you tell?
We do.
But it is great that you're here. It's great that you listen and archive, and it's great that you share the show, because we are here with a message, and that is to tell you that it is mass Islamity, and we have to stop the insanity. And, Tim, have a wonderful evening.
Yes, you too, Kel. Have a wonderful evening, and thanks to all our listeners for listening tonight, and thanks for Eric for phoning in. And enjoy your mug, Eric, the grievance mongering Takiyah artist, the mendacious grievance mongering Takiyah artist, will be back with us again this time next week, and another coffee mug will hopefully be finding its way to another one of our listeners. So tune in next week.
Right, you are. And it's funny, I mailed your mug the same day I mailed Bigfoot's, and you got your mug all the way in England, and Bigfoot still hasn't gotten his. Isn't that funny?
Oh, terrible, isn't it? Flipping postal service, I don't know.
He'll get it tomorrow, I'm sure.
Good.
Oh, Tim, I will speak with you soon.
Yes, indeed. You take care now, and I'll speak to you soon, Kel. Good night for now.
Good night, everybody. Oh, I hate this slow startup.
Yeah. Keep hope alive. I know sometimes in life you feel that everything is lost, and that mountain is just too high to climb. Keep hope alive. Well, that's when you gotta dig deep down inside and reach that inner strength you never knew you had to give you the will to carry on another day. And all the day goes by and you're outside still wondering why, watching everything you work so hard and life all begins to fall apart. It breaks your heart to see it all crumbling at the wayside. You wanna lay your head down, pack it in and say goodbye, cause there's nothing left here to keep hope alive until you see the only two things in life that really matter. It's a little girl and a little boy, one's your foolish pride, one's your beautiful joy. Even what's left of a candy bar when it's like the remains of a Chips Ahoy. Playing with a piece of driftwood, they create a little mind made into a beautiful toy. And at that moment you realize you gotta rebuild everything Mother Nature had just destroyed. Their precious little heartbeats gave you the strength of a thousand men, gave you the will to get back up on your feet again. Because you knew right then this battle wasn't about you, it's all about them. And you reassured them like only a daddy can. And they knew right then that everything was gonna be alright. Some harm's way, putting in all those hours, and all my friends working day and night, making it right here, tunnel of towers, bringing us hope like a ray of sunshine, peeking through the clouds.